All right. Welcome, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I am Joe Danier, your host, and we get to talk about things that are happening with business. We kind of give you some real estate to talk about what's happening in your mind as far as ideas and putting them out in the marketplace and making your hobby turn into some kind of a business or just making a side hustle, something that you do in your spare time after your real job, something you're a little bit more passionate about, something that kind of envelops a little bit your character and your personality. And so we like seeing that kind of stuff develop. And so we have this common space here that we can talk through some of the stuff. There's some stuff that, we're looking to shorten the learning curve. We all seem to go through the same challenges. And so that if you're able to learn from someone who's been through it, it kind of saves you sometimes from it lasting a long time, or sometimes you can skip it altogether if you learn just from the cautionary tales coming from other people. One bit of news from this last week, we meet with businesses, we make financial investments, we take stakes in certain companies, we just do coaching, but our overall goal is to help people kind of grow their enterprises, make more healthy enterprises. A lot of people come to my table and they've got good everything. There's just some rough edges that they need rounded out. And sometimes it takes somebody just having your back or creating a bunch of allies. So a partner of mine, we launched a private investment company called Mahoning Valley Business Alliance, and sole job was to take on small businesses, help them grow, expand, give a little bit of trade of equity, and either cast them off and let them go do their thing or package them for sale. Well, this week we ended up having an investment that we took on in 2018. Over the course of three or four years, we these guys were super smart, the operators and the founders. They were really, really good. Lots of business acumen, engineering acumen. I mean, these were real deal guys. And all they really needed was some backing, and not even so much financial backing, just somebody to, bounce things off and a couple extra, conversations and a little bit more, insights from people that might have been in the business world just a little bit ahead. And so fortunately, this thing went really well. There was a sale of the company to a much bigger company. Now, I can't release details because they're still, even though the deal is signed, the information, it would still like to go through the new buyer. Is not something that, that I would want to make anybody mad for. But I just want to tell you, out of Youngstown comes another success story. This is a big victory, and lots of people involved that helped not only put this company together and also, manage, help with the management, help with the business planning, helping with the financing, and then casting it off and packaging it perfectly for a bigger company to acquire and whatever. So that's another big one. So we have one sort of like hole in the portfolio after this week. So we're probably going to be maybe taking on another one and taking them through the same thing. And a lot of these companies, some of them, are looking from day one to be a target for acquisition, where they know that they want to just be bought up by a bigger company. So they work on a slice of technology that they know would complement somebody else out there, either a big Amazon or a Tesla or Apple or something like that. And then all they do the whole time is can get them as put them on this silver platter for Apple to come along and discover them, or the big company to come along and discover them and make a purchase. Because a lot of times, instead of internal development, sometimes it's just acquiring these little companies that solve one of your problems is it. So I just wanted to kind of throw up a firework of celebration for one notch in the belt here. And a lot of you say, and that's the thing about our area, is a lot of these things go under noticed and underappreciated. We do a lot of pointing out the colossal flops, but when we have these big successes, they barely register on the Richter scale of news. And so without a place like this, you'd probably never even know that it happened, because it would like gracefully just go off and whatever. But I'm going to make a big deal about it. When I'm allowed to press release and party down about it, I'm going to totally do that. And again, I hope you'll kind of nose in and pay attention to the people that are making big inroads to bring these kinds of transaction and this kind of activity to our area, because I would really love to even see more of it. And I've been to enough of these either private investment groups where companies come in and make their pitches, to know that there is way more going on in our valley than you will ever know. There's a lot of young talent that's in a constant state of creation. And, you know, you read about it every once in a while, but it doesn't make big news. And that's what we're doing. We're highlighting this stuff. The main topic that I want to talk about today is pricing. I spent a huge amount of time describing and strategizing and explaining and changing sort of like the mentality around what prices should be and what prices are. And every once in a while, you get sort of a natural occurrence in the marketplace where lumber will go up to, you know, unimaginable pricing, and, you know, there's a shortfall in microchips or energy or fuel sector feels the heat on something, either a shortage or, you know, a change in technology or something like that. And all of us on the consumer end, we feel those pinches. But what control and you know, for the most part, most of us in the business world, we set our pricing based on a little bit more complicated of a formula than you would realize. So, you know, some simple versions of pricing where you get into a market and you see what everybody's charging, and maybe you just charge the same and then you'd have to figure out what went into setting your pricing. Or you do what I do. I'm you know, one of my first retail businesses was I was in the pet trade, the reptiles, you know, sort of like iguanas and chameleons and that kind of stuff. And we were doing a ton of breeding. And so we were buying, you know, certain species that were maybe threatened or endangered or maybe just not represented in the pet trade. And we'd have them imported and we'd set up breeding projects to see if we can get animals to, you know, sort of like entered into the pet trade. And I did a whole lot of insect feeding. So most of them would eat things like crickets and whatever. So in typical Joe fashion, I wanted to go better. I wanted to improve the feeding trade, because crickets are okay, but they're not very nutritionally valuable. I mean, animals in the wild don't go around just eating one kind of insect. They go around and they get, you know, all kinds of sampling. So I started looking at different insects that were also available in the pet trade. There just wasn't any. So I there was one company that sold silkworms, and I bought a couple of them, and I figured out how to, you know, breed them and package them and sell them. So I got into the silkworm selling business. Now, as the only person really that existed, I could pretty much set my pricing however I wanted. And so all I had to figure out was if there were any buyers willing to pay whatever I set. And there was one guy who did a small scale, And what I did was I just basically set my pricing like a hair above his pricing. Okay, so let's just say his pricing was a dollar. Mine would have been like $1.10, just a little bit up. Now, my business philosophy is I don't enter a marketplace to do the same as everybody else. I enter a marketplace because I think I can do it better. And usually doing it better has some costs associated to it. So if you're, you know, you take all the business that are the ones that want to pay the least amount, right? I'm going to be a little above you, so they're going to choose you over me. And then I'm going to spend my extra, you know, 10 cents a product to see if I can figure out how to take care of the people who are not just price conscious, see if I could take care of them 10 cents better than you can, and then you can have all the low dollar ones and I'll have everything above that. So as long as there's enough people in the marketplace, that usually works, and that's why the philosophy is sound. I think, you know, when you start a business, you don't want to be inundated with a ton of customers. I'd prefer to have a nice sampling of higher end customers and then figure out how to really take care of them and keep them loyal. I don't like the low margin, high turnover, constantly seeking new customers to replace ones that will never buy from you again. That just never worked for me. I don't feel good when I create something like that. So part of my pricing, that was like a lob. Like, it was just a general. I didn't know it was built into the $1.10. I just did it to be a little bit higher than whatever and then try to figure out what I could do differently than they were doing. And then as you get maybe a couple months into it, I'm like, okay, well, I came up with these ratios that I got real comfortable with. So my total pricing is that all of my labor costs have to come from the first 50%. I feel like that if it takes a laborer, to create something for X, you know, amount of hours, that laborer and me were partners on that. So I want to make sure that 50% of the product cost in labor goes to the person that's performing the labor, right? And so I get the other 50%. And then so I'm working with the 50%. The labor's already paid for by the first 50. And then the second part of the 50% or second part, I've segmented off the next 20% of that I do in marketing. I like to buy marketing and advertising that has a result of about 5-to-1 ratio. So if I spend 20% of my total revenue back into marketing and it nets me a 5x rate of new business, then that's a perpetual loop that, you know, as long as I'm good at doing the marketing side, that kind of works out. And then 20% of that 20% of that next deal is sort of like retained earnings, research and development, and all of the expenses. So the bottom 10%, that's where profit needs to be. So 50% in labor costs, 20% in what I drill back into marketing and advertising, 20% in all of the expenses, the non-labor expenses, and then 10% needs to be profit. So once you start knowing, like the biggest one is once you know your labor cost, it's just math. It's just whoever to provide a product, best case and worst case. You set your pricing on the worst case, and then you know, you make sure that you, once you know your 50% ratio, the other three ratios are pretty easy to be able to fill that in. A lot of you who are doing guessing, you know what the market will yield, and sometimes it's a little unfair to pick what the market will yield because maybe you don't have the functions of what that yield is based in your model. So you're going to go out and provide the service, and the guy that's charging $100 for something maybe does X, Y, and Z, and you're not going to do X, Y, and Z. You're going to charge the same rate as the guy who does 100, but there's going to be some missing stuff if you compare it one for one where somebody experiences them and somebody experiences you. They're going to be disappointed. So you have to know what people are really buying, and it's not usually just the end product. Like if you have a whole host, like let's just say you walk into a market where everybody's busy, and it takes you 6 months to get something. So like furniture right now, furniture is really backed up. And so if I wanted to order a couch right now, I might have to wait 4 months to get the one I want, or I can get one that's sitting in the showroom for whatever. So if I was Joe Business Dude, I can go around and I could build what's in short supply and be able to charge more for it. So either you can go to the normal thing where it's cheaper and buy it 6 months from now, or if somebody doesn't want to wait 6 months from now, they want to buy it now, they could buy from me, and they're paying me for the convenience of buying it now rather than them. That's filling in a very short temporary, demand that cannot be filled by normal producers. And so in your pricing model, again, it's coming and understanding what goes into that. So if you sell a thing and then you have 20% of that thing built into your marketing cost, the more successful you are, the more marketing and advertising that you can afford to spend to even grow your brand more. If you keep your ratios, like 20% is a lot. And even when I was doing, you know, a couple decimal points back in sales and revenue, I was able to still do a good bit of marketing and revenue. And those usually translated to going buying advertising and stuff like that. But as your revenue goes up, now you can spend marketing not just in ads. You can drill marketing into more creative venues and always go back and say, okay, well, if you are willing to do something for a customer that really leaves them with a huge good taste in their mouth, right? They leave you feeling, wow, I got a lot of value. Well, that extra stuff that you do could be considered as part of your marketing because you're doing it for the express purpose of getting people to really like your product, selling them not necessarily on a direct sale, but to tell their friends and tell everybody about how awesome you are. And then that, again, that extra marketing cost can allow you to do so many more cool things that really, really are great for whatever brand. If your pricing doesn't, you know, segment off and let you spend things in other directions, then when the price comes in, you pay your labor and you chuck the rest in the bank and you feel like your marketing expenses are really liabilities. I had one customer that when the 2008 recession hit, or when the housing crisis hit, one of the first layoffs that they did was their sales staff, and I was thinking, you know, that would be my absolute last layoff, was my sales staff. They're instrumental into rebuilding the order book so that I can exist going into the future. I mean, that one, you're going to feel the repercussions for a while. I mean, and I understand when you get boxed in and you feel like you're going to go out of business, you're looking at your expenses on a spreadsheet. That one looks to be pretty big because, you know, salespeople are highly compensated. But the reason they're highly compensated is because they're responsible for filling tons and tons and tons of orders. Now, the exception is that when you do have a true recession and your orders get, jacked, that you know, there just aren't enough buyers to field out the commissions for those sellers in the first place. So I get to a point, that's just my philosophy, that would be the last person out the door would be the sales staff, you know, in that situation. So we'll talk a little bit more about, how you configure some of your pricing, and if maybe you have any suggestions or how you came creative ways of coming up with your pricing, because there's a million different ways to do this. But just because this strategy, you know, has some merit to it, there's a million other ways. The only thing I don't recommend is just kind of picking something you found in the ether and going with it and sticking with it forever. All right, we'll come back. We'll talk some more about this. 330-729-9977, or you can text me at 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show on 570 WKBM. I'll be back. All right. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I'll read some text messages here in a couple minutes and answer some of those questions. The phone number is again 330-729-9977, or you can text me at 333-1570. And so here's another predicament that goes along sort of with setting your pricing. But once you sort of cast your pricing, does it adjust? I started in with Youngstown Computer and doing subcontracting in about 2001, 2002. And my original hourly rate was $35 an hour. And that was a wholesale rate that then, you know, the general rate was about $70, so that a bigger company would be able to take my rate, they'd be able to mark it up to their normal rate, and they'd be able to make a profit, right? So I would get a regular cycle of work from other companies because I carried my own liabilities, right? I was insured on my own. I had all of my stuff was my own. So when they hired me, they basically, everything that I did, I mean, I was super good at the job, never had to really return to a job and redo it or whatever. I was pretty pristine that way. And I knew that my pricing was way low, but I used my lower pricing not to undercut, because it really was – who was I undercutting? There was nothing in the marketplace that I was being less than, right? Because I was really the only dude in town that was, you know, you can come after me and hire me for big projects and then be done with me, and he didn't owe me a full schedule. I was just in demand, and I let people just kind of fetch me. And then I maxed out, right? I was 100% doing my thing, and I started able to start raising my pricing. So it was easy for new customers that came through. They got the new price. So when I raised it from 35 to 50 and then 50 to 55, and I usually went in $5 increments every couple months till it reached a balance where I knew I was in that sweet spot with what I was worth and what people were willing to pay. So because you pick what the market will bear, if you look at your stuff and nobody's buying from you, then that's not quality pricing for you. You can argue with me all you want. If they're not buying from you, then that's not a good price. The price is what people are willing to pay. You know, that's it, bar none. And so my pricing kept going. But what about previous customers? Well, I grandfathered a lot of previous customers into the original rates that they were paying when they signed on with me. So I had some customers that were paying my original $35 rate, and I had some customers that were paying $50 rate, right? And I knew that what I was going to do is I was going to allow them to keep paying that until I couldn't anymore, until I can justify it where I was taking a loss and I would have to raise the rate, being willing to say goodbye if the rate was then beyond what they were willing, you know, were willing to pay. I had to keep making my services easier to justify the rate increases in comparison. I really didn't have to do that, but I sort of had to feel good about raising the rate. So I had to constantly make things easier. Like, my billing was shoddy at the beginning. I was really good at doing the work, but I was terrible at paper trails. I was terrible at regular billing. I was terrible with making things organized. I mean, I'm sure I gave a ton of free work out there just because I was so disorganized. I didn't remember to invoice it, soon enough before I forgot that I was even there. So as I started increasing my rates, I started you know, the guy that works in my office has been with me forever. You know, Ernie was one of those people who helped get my crap together, right? He was my organizational brain, where he and I, where I would call my hours in between stops, and he would make sure that they appear on an invoice. And the invoices then became regular, where they get mailed out every Friday. And all of these processes spawned by because, you know, people who were willing to deal with me when I was kind of rough would expect me to be not as rough as my pricing continued to go up. Now, there was no fear. I mean, I was in such high demand at the time that I could have raised it and kept it the same. But I think there's a principle behind that, that I always want to make sure that I don't want to be fearful that if I wasn't in the middle of a cycle, that I couldn't just repeat the cycle. I had to take myself out of this, throw me on a deserted island. And if I couldn't start my rate right where I was when nobody knew me, I had no notoriety, and I didn't have a flow of customers, then I was overpriced. And I didn't want to feel the pressures of being an overpriced person. I want to make sure that no matter what I did, I was at value, and the people that I was serving wanted to do business with me. And that's why I never did, you know, managed services and contracts and whatever, because it didn't jive with what I was trying to do. If you were dealing with me, I wanted to make sure that I deserved to be in you. I wanted to be there, and that forced me to earn your business forever, right? And so if you didn't want to pay the rate, I was cool with that. It wasn't anything personal, and you can go find somebody who's at that rate. But I was moving in this direction because I wanted my product to get better on a conceptual level and you know, on a philosophical level too. I had a trajectory that I was aiming for. So again, I went from $35 and my rate now is $125. Now that's over the course of, you know, every bit of 20 years. So, but as you can see, I was able to keep growing, and it'll continue to grow from now. If you check the regular rate, for people in the tech field, I'm probably on the low middle of where that market is. So if I looked it up and see what the market drivers were behind pricing in tech, I'd be overpriced at this point, and I wouldn't feel like what I provide right now is worthy of that, you know, upper tier of pricing. But that's just this game that I'm playing in my mind, and it because it had a starting point where I had to get really confident in what my pricing was, so I could defend it and I could be proud of it. And I never wanted to apologize for charging money for what I was doing. But I also had to test it and make sure that because I was in such a high demand, that I wasn't raising my labor rate like the lumber rate right now and just kind of scalping people because they couldn't do without me. So that's how I kept myself in check, but I didn't also undervalue myself or go after the, you know, lowest common denominator on dollars, because that race to the bottom sucks for everybody. I mean, we want those costs or those prices and wages and all that kind of stuff to go up. All right, 330-729-9977. You can text me at 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show here on 570 WKBN. I'll be back. All right, welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. Last week, we had a caller that was in the banking industry, retired from the banking industry, and they brought up that I don't really talk about sort of like traditional lending, bank lending to start businesses. I mean, you have options as far as funding goes, and we don't spend a whole lot of time with finding the financing behind that. A lot of what we see from our standpoint is a lot of private investing, where we go in front of people who do investing, you know, for a living, or they have investment portfolios where they take minority stakes in companies that are sort of like in sexy industries that are easy to sell, right? But having traditional lenders along the way is not a bad deal. And in fact, I started sort of polling a couple of the local banks to see what their underwriting process is. And, you know, some of it is dependent on, you know, your credit or your revenue and stuff like that. But there are still some lenders that will buy into your business model, you know, you giving a pitch to a bank, and then they basically are your you know, financier. I've never experienced a traditional bank loan from a local bank. And so that's why I thought about that afterwards. Like, why don't I talk about that as an option? I mean, for two reasons. First, I am really averse to debt risk when it comes to institutions. I've been in enough businesses to know that if you have 10 businesses, not all of them are going to be a success. Some of them are going to go bye-bye. So if I'm going to have 9 businesses or 7 businesses out of the 10 fail, which ones do I want to have debt invest in it? I'm going to say zero. I only want to fund my company after it's proven out to be a success or failure. So I live in the space of building to a certain level, right? Fixing, rehab, stuff like that. So it, you know, most banks won't even look at me when I'm in that deal because I don't have revenue and the plan's not even all that great and the history's not all that great and the potential is not that obvious. And so that's my job, is to build that up. So I don't usually go after traditional institutions because I know that they would pretty much not be interested in something. You know, I can always tell when something is on the verge of being marketable, you know, where it's either a good acquisition target or somebody I know that somebody would give me a real investment or a complete buyout, is when I start getting approached from institutions asking me if I would like to take on partners or I would like to take on investment. That means I'm making a big enough splash and people see what I'm doing and it's all money held internally. By that point, I don't really need outside money. But sometimes it's worth taking those meetings because of just the people that will connect to the business because of that. So first thing is that I'm really averse to debt on companies that are not proven. And then I'm a scaler, so that if I can't make it work financially when it's small, I don't necessarily think I can when it's big, my skill set only. And I'd like to not have debt along when I'm making mistakes, because then not only do you have to have the mistake, you have to pay for a mistake for a, you know, extended period of time, and that might take away from a future plan. But if you're in an industry or you're opening a company that needs, you know, machinery, you know, I need to buy a $1 million 3D printer and I don't have $1 million in the bank, I've got to seek somebody who has some cash, make them the pitch of what this 3D printer would do for my company, and get them to say yes and give up some equity in the company in order to do that. That's traditional. So you have private investors, people that are just in your communities that do that. All it takes is asking around. And you know, if you ask a guy like me, if they're, you know, where the next, you know, business pitch is going to be, I could probably look that up for you and find that to you. So if you're looking private money, that would be my preferred. Everybody who's in private money already knows that their risk is involved, and they are in, you know, is if you stick to your plan and you sign on that dotted line and you do all the right things, then, you know, they understand the risk going into it. And it's not like a traditional loan where it's like, hey, this didn't go bad, sorry, you still owe us the money kind of a thing. And then my preferred. So traditional, private, and then internal. Internal is my favorite. It is the slowest growing, but I believe it has the most health associated. If you build up a practice where you basically cash flow all of your your expansions, and then you can grow that company fast enough to keep up with the expansions. All of my enterprises, all you see, Youngstown Computer and Youngstown Makerspace and the studio, all of that stuff was cash flowed. There's no private interest. And in that, I couldn't even invest that. At a clip of how it was coming in. So we ended up investing in other companies along the way. So it can be done where you can cash flow things internally if your model's good enough and if you're patient for that stuff to happen. A news item here, we have Route 45 up Palmyra Road is closed at the moment due to a bad accident. So thank you for that. And Medvac is there, so avoid that area. Find an alternative route, please. So that is, again, Route 45 out Palmyra Road is closed at the moment due to a bad accident. So thank you for that, Dave Price. If anybody does need anything in the business world, I am going to be taking on another minority stake. I'm almost certain of it. If you want to pitch some of your ideas, get in contact with me. Send me an email, joe@youngstowncomputer.com. And then I will put you on the whiteboard. And when it comes time to start filling in the time that I would dedicate towards this other company that we sold off, I will be entertaining new companies in the future for growth and investment and rehab and all that other stuff. So thanks for paying attention to the show. I appreciate all the contributions. I hope I answered all of your questions. I really hope that some of you will get off the sideline and start getting involved. Start making this world a better place. Bring your talents and your genius into the marketplace. Please make me that. Do me that favor. All right. Stay tuned next. The Youngstown Computer Show is up next.